At RCR, we're on a mission to revive honest media, to report on critical censored stories, and to hold those in positions of power to account. But to make this happen, RCR needs to grow and grow fast. And for that, we need your support. Our Foundation Members Club is now open. Join us today and play your part in bringing back media you can trust. Learn more at www.realitycheck.radio/members and see how you can join the mission that's making a difference.
This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Welcome to the Fourth Estate here on the Reality Check Radio for Friday the 24th of May 2024. My name is Alistair Harding, and today on the show we're discussing the TVNZ restructure and its massive redundancy bill and the media's reporting of the inflection point event in Wellington. Also the death of Rory Nairn and the non-reporting of the Who and You event hosted by RCR in Auckland last Friday night. And to help me do that, let me introduce our panel today. First up, we've got Yvonne Van Dongen. Yvonne is a freelance journalist who, among other things, writes about gender ideology, so she's no doubt going to have a bit to say about the inflection point story. She's also written for some of the biggest names in the legacy media in New Zealand, including the New Zealand Herald, The Listener, North and South Magazine, and Business Desk. And today she joins us for the first time on the Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio. Welcome, Yvonne.
Thank you for that really lovely description. I'm pleased to be here.
And our second member of the panel is Liel Tilsley, a woman who wears many hats. She's a wife, a mother of three incredible young men, a community developer specializing in emergency response, and also a reporter for the Daily Examiner. She's also a regular on the Amoa podcast and the Talanoa Sa'o podcast with Elliot Ikele. Welcome, Liel.
Thank you, Alistair. Nice to be here.
Awesome. Okay, so let's get stuck in. First up, who wants to bite on the TVNZ story? We're talking about restructuring that's happening over there at the national broadcaster. Fairgo's gone. Who could miss that? Sunday's gone. That was quite a good show. And these programs alone costed $2.7 million and $1.5 million to make every year. And the restructuring is going to cost about $2.6 million, according to OIAs. If it costs that much to stop them, then perhaps that is a sign that a restructure is needed, perhaps. Ladies.
Clearly, they wouldn't be doing it if they were going to make money from these programs. And it is hard to believe for all of us who have grown up with it, but these programs are hemorrhaging viewers, just as the media is hemorrhaging viewers and readers and eyeballs. So they've got to make changes, and they probably will take it to a digital format, I think. The bit that interested me was because I've been following ReNews, only because, I don't know if you've ever watched ReNews, it costs $1 million a year to make. And it's really just like the PR arm of the woke agenda or the kind of cultural, whatever, you know, debate. And they do topics really, you know, how the New Zealand public health system is failing trends, and I'm a sex worker and I'm asexual, and how colonisation has changed the naked body. And I've seen on that program women having their breasts cut off, all sorts of things. It's garbage, I think. It's not what I'd call journalism. But anyway, I'm quite dry-eyed about some of them disappearing, that sort of thing disappearing. But it cost $1 million a year to make that, you know?
Well, Fair Go had been on the air since I remember it when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
It was a national institution. So there is, I suppose, some nostalgia in that show.
Yeah.
But Leo, I understand you missed all of it.
Okay. Just a little tidbit about me. I've never owned a TV my whole life. And my poor boys went through the same thing. But when I was young, just like you, Alistair, when we were young, I did watch Fair Go and my parents, you know, when I was living, growing up. And I actually found them to actually be an accountability program, which I think New Zealand wanted and needed, because who do they voice this kind of thing to? And also Sunday apparently is quite a family orientated show as well. So are we taking away the traditions and the values that New Zealand grew up with? What are we changing it to? Where is it going?
And what's going to replace the loss of these shows too, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We won't be sitting around as a family together watching the same show. That's clear, isn't it? We've all got our own screens. and we're watching our own things. It's true. And also that accountability, you're absolutely right, Liao, but I think now people have other ways of doing it, don't they? They can post reviews, they can complain. There's just so many different ways to respond and to say you're unhappy with service, I think. So, you know, it's not the only thing. Once upon a time, it was the only outlet, really, and the only way you could get justice. But now I think there are other ways.
Like protesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really annoying, those online, you know, things. I mean, they can be gamed, can't they? People saying you're terrific or you're rubbish. But that is a thing. Yeah, and people obviously not watching. People are losing television, their whole losing the television habit. People don't turn on the news anymore, you know, so that changes New Zealand's everything. Sociologically, it changes us.
What about the actual cost of doing this? You know, we're talking about $2.7 million just to shut these down. What does that say about TVNZ and the way it's being run?
No, I was just going to say, one of the things they said in the article was, look, and we're just trying to take away the perception that we're getting paid high, you know, amounts of money. It was like, everyone knows how much, you know, that you are really well paid there. So that is quite a lot of money to restructure and to make people redundant.
Yeah, but I worked out there's 68 people they're making redundant. And so I put 68 into 2.6 million. It's something like 38,000. I didn't think they were huge redundancy sums. I'm sure people get more. I don't know. I mean, most people don't get redundancy anymore anyway, do they? But I didn't think it was enormous. But I'm sure everybody there is paid a handsome salary.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. If it comes down to that much, I hadn't done that maths myself. But that doesn't sound unreasonable, does it?
No, I didn't think so. And it wouldn't be that everybody got 38,000. Some people would get more, some people would get less. But it's 68 people is a lot. And I think that they've won something through this E2 thing, haven't they? They're extending their employment for a couple of weeks. So it'll cost more.
I think to me, probably the biggest issue is that this is going to create a vacuum. You know, they're going to have to fill those spaces in the programming with something else. And I'm worried about what they're going to fill it with. It'll be cheap and nasty, something from somewhere else, probably produced overseas. And that's what worries me most, that these were programs, these were shows, Fair Go and Sunday, which told the stories of New Zealanders. Yeah, we can probably all discuss and debate on whether they were telling them all that fairly, but that's all part of the national debate. They were shows which told New Zealanders stories, and they're gone now.
That's true. It is sad. That is sad. And they were identities, and they came into their living rooms, and they were part of our cultural landscape, and that's gone.
Mm.
And it is that loss of a unified kind of view of New Zealand, because it is so fragmented. Everybody's doing their own little thing. Yeah, it does make you wonder how you craft the idea of a nation, or how you craft a society when you don't have those. I suppose you've got sport. You've still got sport, haven't you, that unites people?
Yeah, but I was actually just thinking about that subject just the other day. You know, radio sport was one of the first ones to go during the whole COVID era. And, you know, all of the sport now is also behind a paywall. It's all on Sky TV. It used to be something that unified New Zealanders because it was on TV1, wasn't it? But, you know, just like this, the money speaks and they retreat behind a paywall, or they don't exist at all.
Yeah. Well, I suppose people may have the choice to fund it themselves. That's how it goes now, doesn't it? Maybe we could pay for Fair Go. Maybe we could pay for Sunday. I don't know what there'll be a new iteration somehow. They're going to have to work it out. I'm sure it's dawning on them.
Talking about the fragmentation of New Zealand, let's talk about the inflection point event that happened on the weekend down in Wellington. I just want to frame this. The media spent all week trying to talk New Zealand into rejecting this event. But from my point of view, it was a strange message. They were at pains to point out they wanted to be inclusive, but they wanted to exclude this event because people like Posey Parker and Brian Tamaki were speaking at it. And they were also at pains to paint the organisers as hate-filled and violent people, even though the last time Posey Parker spoke at an event in New Zealand, It culminated with a 70-year-old being punched repeatedly in the face and a violent mob storming the stage and dousing Posey Parker in tomato sauce and being escorted away by police. It's quite bizarre that the media did not frame this event in that context, because that's the context that it was happening. And likewise, for people that seem so intent on talking about inclusivity and safe spaces, it's strange that they didn't want to extend that inclusivity and safe spaces to the other side of the argument, which in this case was the inflection point attendees and organizers. But that's my point of view. Ladies, what are your points of view on this one?
So I was there at the Posey Parker event, and I was escorted out. I was escorted out by the police because the mob was getting bigger and bigger, and they said they couldn't look after us. So the safety thing. So they escorted the people who wanted to just be there to have a different opinion. So the police escorted us out, and so the mob just got more and more in sight. So there was nothing to deal with the bullying that happened there. In fact, they gave over to them. So if that is the kind of thing that's happening, how is that going to be ever addressed if even the police couldn't handle what was happening? So when it came to that event, how are they going to handle any of this? And should it be their responsibility?
I think they paid quite a bit for that's security. I think they had to at the last minute.
You're talking about the inflection point.
Inflection point. I do believe that they did have to, although I think it was requested by Takina, I think, because of various threats. And I think that the protesters, because I was at Posey Parker as well, the protesters were separated in this one, an inflection point, from the people going into the conference. I don't think they had to kind of elbow their way through a vicious crowd. They were much more careful about separating people because there was no separation at the Posey Parker thing. There was a sort of a line and then they just mobbed us. It was awful. So that was a sort of an improvement. And I sort of was thinking about the Posey Parker event. There's a mild improvement because last time there were politicians speaking up like Chris Hipkins and, you know, saying this is terrible, and the Greens and
Kerry Allen and Marama Davidson were very vocal at the beginning of the week leading up to the Posey Parker event, weren't they?
Totally. And also Chenille Lal.
That's right.
Remember how vocal he was? And they just whipped up people to make it sound like the Posey Parker lot, there were a bunch of neo-Nazi, trans-hating, I don't know, it was just insane. And so it seemed to be a slight improvement. I mean, I don't want to give too much credit, but they only got Tory Farnow to say something in a Wellington City Council. There were no politicians. I was surprised that they did. Chenille Lal works with Carmel Cipollone in Wellington. I'm surprised that they didn't talk to him or find him or anything, you know. And no one from Labour or Greens spoke out again. So there was a slight improvement, I think. But they still had a lot of people, and the thing that people didn't realise was that Brian Tamaki, they promised, Takina promised to provide recording facilities, or I think that's part of the deal, and then they didn't have it at the end, and then Brian Tamaki flew down two people with the gear especially, which is really amazing, I think. So I thought there was a slight improvement in the reporting, slight.
One of the pieces that I read about this was the spin-off. They did a review of it. And I'd say that one of the biggest problems with what's going on in New Zealand today and in the media and specifically, because that's what we're talking about on the Fourth Estate, right, is that the thing that needs to be fixed here is this bias or this vacuum where they just don't talk about one side of the story. So there's this one paragraph in this spin-off story, and I'll just read it out. I quote, "As the crowd finds their seats, I chat with Caleb, a 20-year-old law student at Victoria University. He tells me his high school was indoctrinated by trans-inclusive sex education. And then he quotes, and then a year later, everyone in the class started transitioning. At his university hall, the dining room was adorned with LGBTQ+ flags that made him feel uncomfortable. Other students shunned and ostracized him for his views. This is the problem. You know, ironically, that's exactly what the protesters outside who also we haven't mentioned yet, they were throwing stink bombs at Brian Tamaki and so on. They were talking about how their voices weren't being heard, that they were being suppressed. But here we have a direct quote from somebody who is saying, look, I'm feeling uncomfortable in a situation. Can't we actually even talk about it? But instead, we're not talking about it. We're pushing them into a room with a stink bomb on a weekend afternoon and not telling their story at all. This is the problem which is actually dividing New Zealand on all sorts of issues at the moment, is it not?
Yes, I completely agree. Yeah, I'm sure we both agree, Lau. Yeah. There's a huge divide between the New Zealand public and all the elite institutions. The establishment is woke. It really is. And they're infested with gender ideology in academia, in the media, and just everywhere, in public service. They're infested with it, and they don't realise that, or they may realise the public isn't on board, but they treat us like we just don't understand. They're members of the Church of Gender Woo. Mm. And they're going to impose this on us. And every survey shows Middle New Zealand is not on board. They don't run those surveys. They don't publish the information. There's so much that they avoid to maintain the illusion that, you know, things are all tickety-boo, but they're not. They're not. People are very unhappy.
I know, it's fine. I just found that article very... I came away with a sort of a bitter taste in my mouth reading it, because he made a very negative slant as soon as he started speaking about sneaking in and sitting there and, you know, almost mocking every person that talked except for the one who had life experience in it. So there was no sort of neutral bias towards, hey, I'm gonna get as much information and here it is. No, he wrote it in a way that it was very, very negative and just made me think, you know, that kind of feel, if I didn't know what would be spoken, I would have, you know, looked at it and thought, there's no way I would have ever attended something like that. That's the kind of writing he had.
Liao, that article, right, in the very first sentence, he's talking about the stink bomb, how it stinks, and he's trying to make some sort of comparison, saying that the whole event stinks, right? But in actual fact, that stink bomb or whatever it was, it was thrown at Brian Tamaki. That was an act of violence against the people who were going to that event. And he was using it in a completely different way. He was trying to use it as a way of smearing the people that were there instead of actually talking about why it occurred. It was a very dishonest piece, wasn't it?
And in a permeate, he put it, that's right. He made it so it permeated right through the whole article. So he kept bringing it up. Every time they had a break, he talked about the stink. And I was like, actually, it's the writer. It's the writer that stinks. This is so, you know, it actually didn't make me feel very good after reading. Like, you know, just as someone who didn't go to the event, just the way he kind of snuck in, said things about the guards watching him, you know, and asked him to, you know, that kind of sort of real, New Zealand's not like that. Why are you making it like that? Why are you making it so everyone's so divided? If he had just come in, sat down, just did his thing and not to, you know, he was probably going, hey guys, I'm writing a note, you know, because no one would have noticed him. He would have just been one of, you know, the crowd there. But no, it had to have some sort of attention to go with it. Like, I didn't like it at all.
Are we... Let's address what that spin-off story is trying to say and the RNZ stories that we read researching the show as well. Are we an anti-trans society?
No.
Is there a problem?
No, I've been thinking about writing a story about where is this trans whānau? You know how they're going to protect their trans whānau? And I thought, well, where are they? Is there anybody trans speaking out that's not there? It's always straight people who want to be queer or... You know, it's the trans whānau are not speaking out and saying, I've got a problem, this is wrong, but it's just not true. It's not true. And I don't think people who are concerned about safeguarding women and children can be said to be anti-trans. There's something really sinister going on here. It's using that language, but in fact, we're talking about gay conversion therapy. We're talking about kind of trans sadists, people medicalizing children and putting them on the pathway of surgery. And most of these, or many of these children, would left alone, all the research shows, would be gay. There's a certain proportion that are autistic, some of which are have been sexually abused. But, and so this is what we're talking about, gay conversion therapy. It's not, you know, it's serious, I think.
When you start to label someone or label them, that actually, you feel like you have the right to treat people however way you want. So when you start to say anti-trans, you feel that you have the right then to be superior and start treating people however way you want. So when you start bringing these labels out and making, I'm not anti-trans, I love people. People are just my thing. It doesn't matter who you are. But once you start labeling people that, you then have in your mind the right to do whatever you want to them. I think that's disgusting, and we should not accept any of that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, that's dehumanizing us, isn't it? And I think it's a narrative. They want to believe that to make them seem more righteous. But I've seen some of the letters that Madeline Chapman has written. She's the editor of the spin-off, in response to complaints. And she says, we at the spin-off believe trans people are real. So she believes, she says it's the same as climate change. So she believes that there is such a thing as a trans child. You can be born in the wrong body and you can change sex. These are all articles of faith. It's not true. It's not true. But if you do believe that, then you see people like us saying it's not true as apostates, and you've got to shun us, and you've got to say you people are wrong. She believes it's possible.
Well, I'm sure it could be. It could be possible in one way or another. But if you take one side, you take the other side of that argument out of the equation, then we can't discuss it. Then we can't find out what the truth is. And that's the problem. That's why freedom of speech is so damned important. It's as important as food, water, and warmth for us all. Because if we take away one side of the argument, then we're only going to make mistakes. And, you know, perhaps some of these kids who are transitioning and cutting off their breasts and things like that, maybe one day they will come back to regret it. Maybe they won't as well. But unless we can talk about it, then we're never going to find out the truth about it, are we? And then I suppose that's where my criticism of this media coverage is that you can see it straight through that spin-off story and the RNZ stories leading up to it. They never once try to understand what the purpose of the event was or the people that were there. And in the end, all you get is a dark room filled with angry people. And I don't think that's good for New Zealand at all. So then the next question, the next story that we can ask on this topic is the one about the New Zealand Herald story about the young woman, 18 years old, who decided that she wanted to be a man because, in the story it says, because she wanted to go to a pool party. And she researched this on the internet and she started to try and cut her breasts off. And I find this really, really disturbing. Liel.
Yeah, I found it very disturbing, but and I do have a couple of points that I wanted to bring up. One is, as a mother, I was thinking, so during this process, where were the parents and why were they not involved in this particular article? You know, we're talking about just normal mainstream, not mainstream, I'm talking normal general public reading this. Where were the parents? And I'm thinking about, in the article, it said, after years on a stretched public health system, so apparently she was on the waiting list for years. So the article changed from her to he, so it became confusing for one. But also, my main point I want to bring up with this article is, so when she went and cut off her breast, and then she went to the hospital, obviously, it said later they removed her other breast. Okay, so as a mother, you know, with my kids growing up, when they have tantrums, I deal with the tantrum, not with, so that teenager had a tantrum about it, cut her breast off, and so they removed the other one as well. So is this setting a precedent for any other teenager who says, you know, I'm going to do this because I can't wait? Is that going to happen to them? What is going to happen? You know, even if I feel like doing this, is this going to be what kind of attention are we allowing our kids to have? And making this article like it was all, you know, he was fine afterwards, you know.
Yeah.
That just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, the whole story didn't make sense because it said that they've been on a waiting list for ages, but I don't think you can go on a waiting list until you're 18. So she couldn't have been on for years. It just did not make sense. And then it was weird that I think it's very concerning that they said that she found these YouTube videos and that's how she was working out how to cut off your breasts. I mean, should that have been allowed? Should that have got through as an editor? Would you have? Because we used to not be able to describe means of suicide. Should you be able to say?
Well, we still can't.
Yeah, that's right.
We still can't.
So should we be? That seemed quite alarming to me because there are lots of copycat things. And I thought there'll be somebody reading this now thinking, oh, great, I can go to YouTube. And then she was assessed as not having any mental health issues, which I thought, surely an attempt to cut off your breasts is a sign of poor mental health. But she was deemed to not have mental health issues. I've done so much about the story, so many questions, and as you say, where are the parents? It made no sense.
I've been working on a story, a documentary about some research about antidepressants. And one of the main people that we've been telling the story about is a young man who ended up killing himself a number of years ago when he was 17 years old. And it all started from when his girlfriend, when he was 16, broke up with him and he started to self-harm. And that's when he was taken to the psychiatrist who then put him on the antidepressants, which ended up actually pushing him into a spiral, which caused his suicide. And when I read this story, all I'm reading is that she was self-harming. This girl was self-harming. Yeah. And instead of trying to help her, they enabled her.
Yeah. It's such a sinister ideology, I think. It really is. So it's predatory, it's child abuse, it's conversion therapy. The effects of it are not just women talking about gender and what, you know, people not going, males going to toilets. It's a really dangerous, sadistic kind of conveyor belt of drugs and surgery, I think. And it's got to be called out. So when everybody's saying, oh, I care about the trans far now, I thought, why don't you care about these children being forcibly converted? It's gay conversion therapy. Why don't you not care about that?
What I found really interesting within this same article is one that said that they had been waiting for years, but then further down it said that she had been considering it for years. You know, so there's that, you know, that the two kind of, okay, this doesn't make sense. And then the actual it led to this act of desperation was what it was. What about the people who are waiting for actual surgery?
Yeah.
You know, for, you know, life.
She jumped the queue, didn't she?
Yes.
Yeah.
Life threatening surgeries.
Yeah.
They have to be put aside for this gender affirming surgery. Like, at what point is New Zealand going to go wake up?
Yeah.
We actually need to do something.
Yeah.
Our health system's already, you know, on its knees, really.
So why are the media taking this standpoint? Why are they pushing this? You know, there was no criticism of the situation whatsoever in this story, was there?
No,
none at all.
No, it was a PR job, wasn't it, for young people to get their breasts removed, really. That's what it was.
With a tantrum.
Yes, I can see what kind of mother you were.
Have a tantrum and you can get it removed.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, puberty's tough. And so why do people take everything they say so seriously? I mean, they're confused. Why are they? That I just think the whole basis of gender-affirming care is completely wrong, that you have to just accept anything the young teenager says. If they say they feel this, or they say they feel that, you're supposed to accept it and go along with it. Well, it's dangerous. It's foolish and dangerous, I think. And the media, why are they doing it? Because they all believe. They're believers. They believe this thing, really. They think that they're doing the right thing and that they're empowering these people. I can't believe they've all been so sucked in. I can't. I think they'll look back in time, don't you? I just think this is a denial of biological reality. How can people do this? I just don't understand it. really. You have to do some clever mental somersaults to make that, to believe that you can be born in the wrong body. There just is absolutely no proof.
Talking about mental somersaults, I'd like to move us on now to the Rory Nairn story, because this is a story which I've been following ever since the very beginning. And we've always been told that the vaccinations were safe and effective. It was just repeated by the media all the way through. No doubt funded by the Public Interest Journalism Fund and all the advertising that was going on at the time as well. But it was pretty clear that these vaccinations were invented very, very quickly. And there was no way that they could know what the long-term effects were. In fact, we've just had in the news recently, we've seen that with the AstraZeneca vaccine that's had to be withdrawn because they've found, as time goes on, that the long-term data does show that it does hurt people, causes blood clots. And we also knew at the time about Rory Nairn, there are OIAs out there where it shows that the government knew that that injection caused pericarditis and myocarditis, which ended up killing Rory Nairn. And I think that's why I'm just so invested in the story, because what we've seen is we knew, everybody knew at the time, yet they kept on telling us. And Rory ended up taking this injection because he wanted to go to his wedding, and he wanted people to be able to go to his wedding as well. And so I find it very, very hard to swallow this reporting that, oh, it's still being reported as rare. It's still being reported as, you know, relatively unknown, and they're throwing the pharmacy under the bus. I know you've been following this story as well, Liel. How do you think this is being reported?
Well, you know, in order for them to actually deal with the situation, they have to admit it. But we had even our Prime Minister from the last government say, this is safe and effective and you won't get sick and you won't die. You know, it's been videoed, this kind of stuff right from the top. And you also had this, you know, come to us because we are your one source of truth. And so you have people right throughout the country believing, you know, the government's, you know, it's the government, and we kind of believe it. You know, during that time too, I had my sons, my middle ones, say to me, Mum, I really want to go to this concert. And I said, well, I'll tell you something, I'm not going to force you not to, but have a look at everything that this Prime Minister has said and what has she delivered. You go away and think about it. And he came back and he said, you know, actually, I'm not going to get it done. And then all the concerts were cancelled. So this is the kind of sort of playing back and forth of your mind. You know, it really does that to even our younger generation. So you have people who are coerced by their jobs, who, you know, and Roy was the only one that actually came to the light because his amazing fiance just kept pushing at it, saying, this needs to be, you know, something needs to be done. They were a beautiful couple about to get married. You know, that really does, you know, hurt your heart when you realize, you know, the partner's, you know, gone for through this experiment. And I just think it's absolutely disgusting that even AstraZeneca, we're talking about the rare, they're withdrawing it because of the rare factor. And you can see everywhere throughout every nation about the all-caused death mortality rate has gone up by, you know, and we're still just going, you know, I'll just say it, pussyfooting around, you know, just the rare things that occur. This is constant, and it keeps coming up, and people are just, you know, they're sick of it, but they're also ignoring it. They're just like, okay, whatever. Oh, the last 3 years was terrible. I'm just going to carry on with my life.
Yeah. Yes, that's me, Liao. That is me. I am putting my head in the sand, and I do want to forget it, and it was awful. But what are you saying that so Rory is one person who died. Are you saying there's a lot more that we don't know? Or
that's the claim, yes.
I mean, is that the claim? Or is one...
That's the claim.
That there are more?
Well, first of all, you know, I think Alia, one of our co-founders from at RCR here, Alia Bland, she wrote on Twitter this week in response to the News Talk ZB story about this. I quote, we at VFF knew and wrote about the clear safety signal data coming out of Israel early in 2021 regarding myocarditis, particularly in young men. We published the reports on our Facebook page, which was pulled down for sharing uncomfortable information that was most problematic to the government's safe and effective narrative. If we could find this information published in the mainstream press in Israel, why couldn't you, News Talk ZB? I think that's just perfectly said. We have known this stuff for a long, long time. On the inquiry sessions on Reality Check Radio, I've interviewed Nathaniel Mead, who is the lead author on a study which looks at Pfizer's own clinical trial data. And it shows all of these problems right from the very beginning. It also shows the cancer problems that these vaccines cause. We have known about it. Pfizer has known about it. If the New Zealand government didn't know about it, then either they weren't doing their due diligence or they were criminally negligent. In one way or another, they did know about all of this right from the very beginning. And in that context, Rory Nairn was convinced to go to his wedding, he needed to go and have this, and it ultimately ended up in his death. And he's not the only one. They try and make it out to sound like he's the only one in the media, but he's not. And it's becoming painfully clear. And so that to me is the reason why I don't want to ignore it, Yvonne. It's a lesson that we need to learn, and it's going to be a damn painful lesson.
Do you think that, don't dispute what you're saying, but had you known, was that a trade-off that's worthwhile? Would more people have died if we hadn't had the vaccine, do you think? If we, you know, what was the alternative?
Well, one of the problems with that is that, you know, in our former Prime Minister's own words, it didn't stop transmission.
Yeah.
It didn't stop you getting it. The best that they could provide in their own words was it'll stop the symptoms being as bad.
Yeah.
We also know throughout this, and we've known this right from the very beginning, the Diamond Princess cruise ship proved this. The U.S. Theodore Roosevelt U.S. military ship showed us this. That the death rate from COVID was extremely low. And we also know people die at a higher than the life expectancy. We know this. So is the vaccine actually helping anything? More and more, all of this, the data comes out and it shows that it's actually not doing anything. In fact, it's compromising people's immunity. The more boosters people have, it's showing that the more likely they are to get COVID.
What about the graphs that you sometimes see that New Zealand had a very low death rate and that was to do with our high vaccination rate? What do you say to that?
Well, one of the people that I've interviewed is Nick Hudson on the inquiry sessions, and when he looks at it, he says, well, you know, was it just the flu rebranded? You know, the flu disappeared during this time, didn't it?
But globally, we had a very low death rate globally, didn't we? Compared to most other countries, I think we were the one with the lowest. So was that to do with our vaccination rate, or was it to do with the way we live? Why would you put...
Well, we got the vaccinations very late, didn't we?
That's true.
So perhaps was it just that COVID's not actually that deadly?
But we did see lots of bodies die. We did see lots of people dying in Italy and I think in India and all sorts of places. That there was.
I think you're thinking back to those lovely images from China where we saw people lying in the street that had just dropped dead with their shopping still in their hands.
No,
We never saw that happen in New Zealand, did we? So
no.
I kind of look at that and I think, well, was that just some fear mongering from the media on that? Because we never saw that actually happen in real life, did we?
No, I never saw it here. No, I didn't. I didn't see it here. But
we were told it was the same disease.
Overseas, didn't we see in Italy, there was lots of coffins. I remember seeing heaps of coffins. They were running out of space to bury people and all this kind of thing. it was alarming, but it may have been to do with the fact that they lived closer together than we do. And, you know, I really don't know. I don't know.
Well, there was also the case, and this happened in New York as well, where they were putting all of these people into rest homes. And we're talking about the most vulnerable people. As I just mentioned before, the life expectancy, people were dying at actually a higher age than the normal life expectancy. And so when you put people with comorbidities all together in the same location, and trap them all indoors together, then there's also a lot of discussion about the methods they used. They banned the likes of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and they put people on ventilators, which have been proven to actually make things worse. Later on, they started putting people on remdesivir, which also has been proved to be a lot worse. To a lot of us, there are, and if we just to get back on topic, I suppose, to a lot of us, there's all this information that I think this discussion that you and I are having right now is kind of proof of this, that these facts have not been discussed at all, and it's created this vacuum of distrust. Yeah. You know, we were talking when we had the, and we'll get on to the subject in a short while, the Who and You event in Auckland this last weekend. Ramesh Thakur, who is a former UN Assistant Secretary General, he was asked a question at the end of the event about, was the whole COVID era just one big conspiracy? And he spoke back to say, no, I don't think it was. And the crowd basically grumbled. A few people yelled out, well, I think you're wrong, and things like that. But there was a respectful discussion between the crowd and him. He said, no, I don't think there is. And they said, yes, I do think there is, but this is the result. When we're not able to discuss it, all we get is a bunch of grumbly people gathering in a room, just like the inflection point. And we need to be able to talk about these things to be able to get to the bottom of them and actually, you know, get rid of that misinformation or get rid of the conspiracy theories that they talk about. There is so many facts to counter what Ramesh Thakur said. In fact, the next day I got to interview him and I pushed him on that. And I said, hey, look, you know, there is so much evidence. Look at the Diamond Princess. Look at the Theodore Roosevelt. Look at the way that the World Health Organization and Anthony Fauci conflated the IFR and the CFR. All of these different things, it just pointed to the fact that somebody was pushing an agenda. And if we can't have those discussions, we're never going to get to the bottom of it. I'm quite happy to be proved wrong on all of these points. But it seems like, you know, for someone who has tried to ignore it, do you represent the normal New Zealander who...
I probably do. I really, really, really hated lockdown. And if they did it again, I would break it. I just could not. It just seemed awful and inhumane to me. And I just want to erase it from my mind. I can remember feeling like that after the tour, 1981, the tour. I know it's a long time ago, but there was a time there where I thought, if anyone brings up that tour, and I remember Jeff Chappell was writing a book and he was saying, even I'm sick of it. He just couldn't, you know, and I'm glad he wrote that book. But yeah, there's just things you go through. It's too traumatic in a way, perhaps.
So do you not want the media to talk about these things now?
I think it's probably, there's lots of things they don't talk about, and I think it's probably a good idea. I think we decided certain things were settled. I mean, we've decided that the whole trans thing is settled, climate change is settled, this is settled, and we just, nothing is settled, is it really? Not really. We should actually, or we should debate it. We probably should, but it's not going to happen in mainstream media. It's just not.
Yvonne, do you think that this is where we've come to, where we've continually be divided in all these issues because we don't discuss it? We no longer have debating in schools to actually, you know, be okay to hurt somebody else's feelings around it, to actually say your point, because at one point in this, someone's going to be silenced. Is it going to be the truth? Is it going to be the people who speak the loudest? This is where it's coming to, where we, I know that we're sick of it, all of us are, we all went through the same journey together. You know, in order for us to actually have a little bit more of an understanding, it's important, because, you know, other things might come our way. How are we going to deal with that? You know,
I find it hard. It's a bit like climate change. I don't know about you, but I get completely bamboozled by the scientists, by science. I'm not a science specialist. So if one scientist says this and another one says that, I think, well, I'll let them slug it out. But I don't have the chops to really, you know, pull it apart and see what's true or not.
Well, I think you just need to follow the money.
Oh,
you'll find which scientist tells the truth.
Yeah, and on that subject, right, when you see somebody being cancelled who has absolutely everything to lose, and the media is siding with the one that stands to earn billions of dollars, you got to start questioning what the media's motives are, surely.
Do you think the media are complicit in a sort of sinister way, or do you think it's just misguided?
Liel, what do you think?
Well, I knew you were going to point at me to say this. You know, everybody has a conscience, every single person. So if you as a reporter start to go, why am I always slanted this way? And why do I always have to, you know, report this way? Then you start to go, okay, something's not right about this. And something in your conscience says, I need to stand up and talk about this in a, you know, from even for your own voice. Or are you reporting to be paid? So most reporters, when they first start out, they go, I want to find out about, you know, what's happening, and I want to speak the truth. And then you get a narrative from your, you know, from your boss, your producer, who says, I want you to, this is it. This is all you're going to be talking about. So you continue and you continue, and then you just become part of, hey, this is a job.
Yeah.
And where's your passion gone? Where's the thing that made you want to just start in the first place?
I think the passion is still there, but they think that the public are misguided. They think they know better. I really think there is a kind of snobbery. I do. And that, yeah, I don't think it's coming from the top.
Look, we're running out of time, and we still have one last story, which I really want to talk about. But I think that what you're saying there, Yvonne, is a great segue into it, because it's the WHO and You event, the World Health Organization and You event that was held by RCR, Reality Check Radio. It was our event. We put it on Friday night in central Auckland, and the media was invited. There was even a press conference for them to come to if they didn't want to come to the main event. And two world-class speakers, Dr. David Bell, who's worked at the heights of the World Health Organization, Professor Ramesh Thakur, who's worked at the heights of the UN. They were talking about the World Health Organization health regulations that are about to be voted on in the Pandemic Preparedness Treaty. And the media just simply ignored it. This is a subject about our country's sovereignty. It's a worldwide story. We had two world experts on the topic, and the media just ignored coming to it. You know, I'm at a loss. I don't understand. Why would they want to ignore it? And because of ignoring it, they're misleading the New Zealand public, are they not?
They are. They do it a lot, actually. I think that's the way they deal with topics that don't suit their narrative. I've seen it in the gender issue very closely. There's lots of things going on. They didn't get into the WPATH files. They haven't really looked into the CAS report. They don't look into anything that doesn't fit their narrative. They don't ever print Family First career polls, probably because there's, you know, guilt by association, Family First, but also because it shows that New Zealanders don't support this narrative. So yeah, it's looking away and just not writing about it. That's a common tactic. That's really common. I'm not surprised. You should have sent me an invite. It's just around the corner. I would have gone. But not that anyone would print my stories. That's the problem.
Do they not print your stories anymore, Yvonne? Why on earth not?
No, God no. Because I'm a TERF. I'm just, you know, I'm excommunicated, man. Oh, God, I am.
Have you been excluded in our inclusive society?
Oh, I know. It's just so ironic. Everything about it is so ironic. But, yeah, I'm a TERF. And, you know, and I thought, I'm not even campaigning for an ideology. I'm just very fond of reality, and I thought, I'll go mad if I have to pretend men can be women. And it's just, yeah, reality. Could we just have reality, please? But I am, yeah, I know, I'm not, I'm persona non grata in lots of spheres, but never mind.
Yeah, why aren't they reporting on the Who and You event?
Because if they do, then they will have to admit that actually, it starts to crumble. All of the things, all the misinformation that they've, the films, the documentaries they made about, the other people, is would come to a reality that actually it's a bigger picture. And who wants to look at the bigger picture when we can just keep doing propaganda to our own little country? So when you come to a bigger, when there's someone from overseas who's actually been in the this whole arena, who is speaking what they understand and know, why would you want to report it when these past, 5, 10 years has been on one small narrative that New Zealand, why talk about our sovereignty? We don't even have it here in New Zealand anymore. Why are we bothering having to report that?
Well, it's kind of scary looking into it. Say you did look into it, then you might decide that everything we did for COVID was mistaken.
Imagine unraveling that.
That would be just so upsetting because it was such an upheaval and so damaging. Imagine discovering that it was a waste of time.
But this is what I don't understand as well, Yvonne, is that you're a journalist. You know what it's about to get an exclusive or sit on the biggest story of the century. If it really all was a big mistake, if it really was a disaster like I'm suggesting, then as a journalist, wouldn't you want to be the one to break that story?
Yes, I would. The people are running away from stories, not toward them. That's what I thought about that chap at the spin-off that at the conference, because I thought, man, there were some good stories there. There were some good stories, and if they'd been awake, he could have interviewed some really interesting people with some really interesting views. But he just
Like
went
the
to diss it.
detransitioner.
The detransitioner. There's Roe Edge about sports. There is Jennifer Billick is really fascinating. Mia Hughes. I mean, there was just some really good stories and really good data. Jen Rivers, her paper's online, Public Good. It's very, very good about how they've infested the public service. There are some really good stories that New Zealanders want discussed. They do. I know they do.
And the thing is, Alistair, is that we want to be proven wrong. This is the thing. This, like, please prove us wrong, because we don't want this to have happened, but we know it has and is happening. But you don't even have reporters to come and go, we want to prove you wrong. Why? Why?
And to sum up, I think, because we are running out of time now, I just feel that this non-reporting or this ignoring of the other side, all it's doing is dividing New Zealand. And
That's
it's gone
true.
on far too long. We need to stop this somehow. How do we stop it? Just to sum up.
Keeps talking, I think. That's the only thing. Your speech about free speech, that is what I think is crucial. And I'm really glad the Free Speech Union is going into schools, because I'm scared that we're going to lose the art of debate since people are being silenced everywhere, aren't they? They're being silenced, they're being shunned, they have to keep quiet in their workplace. So I think it's really important that we start having those debates.
I think an important thing is to keep asking questions, because you don't want to come across as being superior. You want to be proven wrong, so you want to ask the questions. So just ask people simple questions. That's all you need to do. And sometimes you just have to leave it with them and walk away from it, because it's not even about, it's about them with their own awakening to go, this doesn't make sense. This happened right at the beginning of COVID. I just went, this does not make sense. This does not make sense. And I kept saying that to myself until I started researching and realizing, yeah, doesn't make sense. There's something else greater than this. And so I think just asking questions, don't, say it with wisdom. Don't be superior about it, because we would love to be proven wrong, but yeah, that's what I think. Just keep asking questions.
Okay, get my head out of the sand.
Yvonne, you're wonderful. Don't even
No, not
worry.
really. I know, just some things I can face, but I just could not face the thought that all that lockdown stuff was a waste of time and all the big patients.
Well, and Yvonne, the
Yes.
damage that has been
Yes.
done, the millions of people, I'm talking, this is literally millions of people have been forced around the world into poverty and into famine. And I remember reading stories really early on from the World Food Organization, from the UN, warning about that happening. And that was back in 2020, right at the beginnings of the first and the second lockdowns.
Yeah.
So we have known this stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
But if we don't discuss it, then like Liao says, you know, yeah, if it's wrong, then prove me wrong. And perhaps maybe we'll get closer to the truth because of that. But we're not, are we?
No.
We're not discussing. With that said, though, on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're right on the hour. I want to thank you both for joining me today. This has been a really good discussion. Thank you, Liao. Thank you, Yvonne.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And to all our listeners, thanks for joining us. It's Friday afternoon. I hope you have a wonderful weekend ahead. My name is Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to The Fourth Estate only on Reality Check Radio.
RCR is on a mission to revive honest media. It's a good mission, and now you can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including discounted merch, your backstage pass to join the host for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, and the popular daily curated news summary, RCR Bites, delivered to your email inbox every weekday morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, check out www.realitycheck.radio/members or click the FMC button on the bottom right of your RCR app.